rooms, but then I wasn't a tech. It was their job to manage all the equipment that kept a space-going force alive and fighting. I put Natasha in the lead, and we all trotted after her. I tried to ignore the complaints of the squad and focus on what I was hearing in command chat. So far, it didn't make much sense. There was talk of an enemy force and damage to the bridge. Damage to the bridge? Who could be dumb enough to damage the bridge of a starship inside a warp bubble? We found the oxygen bottles right where Natasha said they would be. Handing them out, we plugged them into our suits and engaged the rebreathers. Our suits were pretty advanced. They would eventually run out of power, but until then they could break down carbon dioxide and recycle it into oxygen again using only a small amount of fresh oxygen from our tanks. Unless we drained the power packs in combat, we should be good for days. It's hard to explain how much better a space-going fighter feels when he knows he has a reliable source of oxygen. Space is a very unforgiving place, and a deadly environment doesn't require an enemy weapon to take a soldier out. Suffocation, heat, cold, or good old-fashioned radiation could do the job just as easily. I had orders by the time we distributed the tanks from the command channel, and I led the squad to meet with Graves and the rest of the unit on the primary training deck. Those who hadn't brought their weapons found armament there, but only snap rifles. I was the only man with a plasma tube in my squad. Graves walked our line, checking our gear. He noticed that Carlos and I were fully equipped for battle.
"Who ordered you to bring your laser carbine, Ortiz?"
he asked Carlos.
"McGill here. He's paranoid."
Graves nodded.
"So am I. Ortiz, you'll stay with McGill. Your job is to keep our only weapon here with a heavy tube breathing. Consider yourself expendable."
"Thank you, sir," Carlos shouted. "I'll throw myself into the first enemy mouth I see, sir."
"Unnecessary, and they don't appear to have teeth. Not exactly."
I frowned. "What are we up against, sir?"
"Invaders. An enemy ship has attempted to block our passage to the target world. We'd have made planetfall a few hours from now, but they laid a trap and stopped us."
We looked from one to the other in concern. A trap? For a ship in a warp bubble?
"There's good news, however," Graves continued. "The enemy took the bridge and killed the Skrull. But they only have a small force and obviously weren't expecting a full legion of heavily armed troops to be aboard. We're going to retake this vessel and the enemy will lose this battle by default. Tampering with a galactic ship? They must be insane."
"I don't understand, sir," I said. "I thought we would be up against some kind of human colonists with delusions of setting up their own mercenary trade."
"We were wrong about that," Graves said. "Take a look."
He tapped at his arm, then applied it to a nearby wall of the ship. The wall lit up immediately, becoming a huge screen. It was a nice trick, but I'd rarely seen anyone do it. Only officers had tappers with high enough administrative permissions. Even the tech specialists weren't allowed to turn the ship into a video playground.
"Watch closely," Graves said. "You'll see a glimpse of the enemy. We downloaded this file from the bridge cameras before they knocked out the surveillance system."
We watched an empty corridor. For several seconds, nothing happened, then shadows loomed. Odd shadows.
"What the hell is that?"
demanded Carlos. For once, no one told him to shut up. We were all thinking the exact same thing. A figure flickered past the vid pickup. It wasn't human, I was sure of that. It moved oddly, loping with an undulating motion. Due to the angle, we didn't see all of it, only a portion of the body. There were thick, snake-like appendages and interlocking plates shaped in diamond patterns. "Something with scales," Natasha said, stepping closer. She lifted her hand to the wall screen as if drawn to it. "Very alien."
"Looks like a bundle of snakes tied together," Carlos said. "Whatever it is, it's frigging huge."
"Not as big as a jugger back on Steel World,"
Keevy said.
Carlos shook his head and chuckled. "Aliens. Freaky aliens. That's just great. Good thing they're morons. They must have no idea how the Empire operates. The Galactics will come here and fry the lot of them. They've made our job easy.
All we have to do is survive long enough to report this incident to the authorities. Take a last look at Zeta Hercules, people. The Galactics will erase it utterly when they hear about this. Soon the enemy will be extinct. Hell, they might even put out the star itself. I hear they do that sometimes.
You might be right, Graves said. But it doesn't matter, because the battle fleet could take years to get here. By that time, we'll be dead, or they will.
We stared at the monster on the screen as Graves replayed it over and over in a loop. It moved so strangely. I've seen my share of aliens on Steel World and in exo-nature vids back home. But these things were weird. There was no earthly equivalent. Just watching it made my skin crawl. Everyone seemed to react the way I did, except for Graves, Carlos, and Natasha. Graves didn't seem to care. He was all business. Carlos was delighted with the idea the aliens had screwed up by attacking our ship. Natasha just seemed fascinated. Graves followed the vid with a little speech about how we were going to first encircle the command deck, then close with the aliens when we had them boxed in. He sounded confident of victory. I wasn't comforted. I couldn't stop thinking that we were facing unknown alien invaders who'd been smart enough to board a starship in warp and disable it. We broke down into squads and advanced. Corvus was a big ship, huge in comparison to earthly vessels. It wasn't like exploring a ship at sea. It was more like exploring a labyrinthine skyscraper. Fortunately, the Skull were nothing if not efficient and logical. They'd laid out the vessel in geometric patterns. The command deck was surrounded by corridors that converged like spokes on a wagon wheel. 8 ways in, no more and no less. All we had to do, according to Graves, was cover all 8 of those escape routes. If we sealed the enemy inside, they couldn't come at us without facing a barrage of fire down a long passageway. Our unit was assigned Lucky Passageway number 7. We marched up and encircled the entrance. The hatch was big, about 10 meters in diameter. All the passages to the bridge looked that way. When we were in position, Graves moved to the panel and used his tapper to override the security. I was glad he was here. Corvus wouldn't have listened to any of the rest of us. Before he opened it, he paused, receiving a message. I listened in as I was still connected to command chat. I made sure I didn't transmit anything. I figured Graves would revoke my permissions and kick me offline when he remembered he'd put me into the loop.
"Graves," asked a female voice, "what's the situation on 7?
I knew that voice. It was Primus Turov, our beloved cohort commander.
"We're about to open it up, sir," he said.
"Hold on that. We have a problem."
I looked at Graves. He was frowning now, but that was nothing unusual.
"May I ask the nature of the trouble?"
he asked.
"The central torus has stopped rotating. There's no gravity in the aft of the ship, and we're having difficulty moving up to join you at your position. You beat the rest of us to 7.
"Standing by," he said.
Now that Turov's voice was no longer buzzing in his helmet, Graves looked around, gazing up and down the passageways. He signaled Adjunct Leeson, who was my direct superior, and who'd brought the rest of my platoon to the party over the last few minutes. Veteran Harris and Weaponeer Sargon were with him, I was glad to see. Altogether, there were now better than 100 troops jammed into the intersection. Gravity was light here, and we were holding onto the walls 10 feet or more up. Like lazy monkeys, we relaxed and gripped rungs that were placed strategically all over the ship.
"Leeson, take your squads and spread out,"
Graves shouted suddenly.
"Move your people down toward the next junctions."
Leeson looked confused, but he didn't argue. He didn't even ask for clarification. Anyone who was in Centurion Graves' unit knew better. He waved to me, and I began to follow him.
"Hold on," Graves said. "Leave me with 2 weaponeers, McGill and Sargon."
A minute later, Graves had dispatched platoons in either direction down the curving passageway. They were only about 100 meters away, but we couldn't see them. Carlos came close to me and clicked his helmet up against mine. To non-spacers, this would have seemed like an odd action, but it was quite common when troops were suited up. By pressing our helmets against one another, we could talk without the muffling effects of being englobed in armor. That way, neither party had to shout or use our radios. It worked especially well in vacuum, where there was nothing to carry the sound otherwise.
"Graves is dispersing us," Carlos said. "That means trouble."
"Don't wet your suit," I said. "He's just being cautious before we open this door and confront the enemy. We're too bunched up here in the passageway."
I didn't tell him about what I'd overheard from Primus Turov. A delay in moving troops up to our position could mean nothing, or it could mean a lot. It sounded to me as if the aliens had realized we were coming, and they were doing what they could to impede the counterattack. This might not be as easy a fight as we'd hoped. When Graves had his troops set up the way he wanted, he contacted Turov again.
"Permission to open the door, sir," he said.
There was silence. Nothing at all came over the line from command chat.
"Primus Turov, this is Centurion Graves. Respond, please."
More silence. I watched Graves. I stared at him through his closed visor. His face was flat, but I thought I saw his cheek twitch in irritation. Why wasn't anyone responding? I thought of a dozen possible reasons. Communications failure was first on the list. Could the invaders have disabled the ship's repeaters, separating us from each other? Graves tried once more, then looked up.
"All right," he said loudly on local chat. "Listen up. We're opening these doors. Look alive, brace yourselves for a pressure change, and ready your weapons."
We snapped lines to the walls and activated the magnets in our boots. Then we lifted our weapons and aimed them at the massive, concave hatch. Graves applied his tapper, and the hatch swung open. Chapter 7. Up until that moment, I'd yet to fire my newly assigned heavy weapon in a combat situation. I'd handled a belter back on Steel World a few times, but I'd been an untrained recruit at that time, using it in a makeshift manner. Now I knew much more about the cannon that rested on my shoulder, and I had an appropriate respect for the weapon. Plasma cannons were weird. They didn't fire a pellet or an explosive. My trainers had told me to think of them as flamethrowers that launched a very brief, powerful gush of flame. They were designed to release a lot of heat and energy in a directed cone in front of the weaponeer who wielded the system. They could be dialed for long or short range, creating a tight beam or a broad area of effect. The range of the weapon lessened if you broadened the beam, but it could hit multiple targets that way, and it was much easier to hit something. Deciding how to adjust your cannon was the business of the weaponeer in question. Accordingly, I made a choice. Just as the doors began to open, I reached up and cranked the stiff collar at the muzzle to open the aperture 2 notches wider. At this setting, it would fire a cone about 30 degrees wide. Sargon, who was on one knee beside me, tossed me a disapproving glance as I did this. I knew it wasn't standard procedure. The enemy was supposed to be at the far end of a long, straight passageway that led to the bridge, and a narrow beam would provide the best reach in that case. I felt myself flush slightly as I caught Sargon's glance. I was a rookie with my first cannon, and we both knew it. I also knew that he wouldn't have questioned a more experienced man. I wondered if I was making a mistake, as he'd kept his beam very tight. There were good reasons for this. There were a lot of troops behind me in a cramped space. I wouldn't be able to fire my weapon without hitting friendlies if things got hairy. Maybe I would have second-guessed myself after catching Sargon's frown, but I was out of time. Committed, I shouldered my weapon as the hatch yawned open like a giant's eyelid in front of us. What happened next was a shock. A number of bizarre-looking hulks stood on the far side of the door. They'd clearly been waiting to greet us. Oddly, we hadn't heard a sound from them before now. Normally, we'd have seen them with the local cameras, but they'd wisely knocked out our surveillance systems. I wondered if they'd been listening to our lengthy preparations, counting us fools all the while. The first thing I registered about them was their size. They were each larger than a man, perhaps 3 meters tall, and much more bulky.
They looked like squids to me, with a dozen tentacles sprouting from the top of their bodies like incredibly thick strands of hair. These tentacles were thicker than a man's leg, and they radiated from a central knot of flesh where I imagined their organs were. There were no eyes that I could see, nor faces of any kind, but in the center of that ball of muscle that connected those snake-like limbs together, I did see something. A beak. That was the only way I could describe it, a mouth built of hard shell or cartilage. The tentacles themselves weren't soft and wet either. They were covered in layered metallic scales, each of which was the size of a deck of cards. There was definitely a quiet, predatory stance to these aliens. They weren't stupid. You could tell that instantly by the way they held themselves and the liquid grace with which they lunged forward. There was no hesitation in them. We were surprised, but they weren't. They were hunting us, I realized. They'd turned off our security cameras, moved to this hatchway, and then waited for their prey to open the door. Probably they'd arranged things so our unit was alone up against them. Now that we'd finally opened the hatch, they were all business. They rushed us. It was as simple as that. They had to weigh a ton each, but as heavily built as they were, they still moved with a flowing grace. They ran forward on their numerous tentacles, manipulating them with perfect rippling synchronization. Sargon fired first. I had to give him that. He took out the lead monster with a gout of energy that sliced right through it at point-blank range. I fired a moment later as they loomed right up into my faceplate. All I could see was a mass of tentacles with a silvery glint to them, shimmering and rattling as they rolled forward into the range of my suit lights. When my weapon went off, the reflection of their scales blinded me momentarily. Two aliens reeled back, smoldering. The rest came on relentlessly. A wave of flesh plowed over me, knocking me onto my armored back. When I could see again, I was being trampled. Sargon was down, too. One disadvantage of our weaponry lay in the slow firing rate of our cannons. You couldn't spam blasts at the enemy. The cannons had to cool down and recycle after every shot. My mind tried to take in everything my senses fed me. A dozen thoughts ran through me. First on the list being that I was about to die. Second, I calculated that since we were out of communication with Central, it could turn into a permadeath. I tried to force myself to focus. I couldn't get up as more enemies were flowing over me, their massive limbs thundering with crushing force upon my breastplate. If I'd been in light armor, I'd have been dead already. Then, one of them fell. A group of soldiers were all around it, firing. Thick, dark liquid resembling dirty motor oil oozed from the smoking holes in its scales. The two-eyed shot were smoking, too. They weren't dead, but they were sagging and flopping. I felt a surge of relief to see I hadn't wasted my single discharge. My unit was in confusion, struggling with the aliens in our midst. I saw two soldiers fly as an alien lifted them up and smashed them together. The monsters seemed to know our faceplates were weak points, and it applied terrific force there, crashing both troopers' heads into one another. The two helmets cracked. Blood exploded an instant later, falling like rain mixed with tinkling bits of starred plastic. The two troops had been rammed together with such terrific force, their skulls had been cracked open. Graves was somewhere in the midst of this nightmare, shouting a string of words over and over. I finally caught what the command was, as did others. "Use force blades!" Every heavy trooper was equipped with a laser carbine, our standard long-range armament. But when things got close and ugly, we had a backup weapon, beams of force that extended like knives from the arms of our suits. While inside a spaceship, using force blades wasn't always the best idea. They could slice through the metal hull of a ship as easily as they could an enemy. But Graves had given the order, so I engaged my blades and angled them upward into the press of bodies above me. Only one of my two blades operated properly. The other flashed an orange fault light at me, and I cursed every tech in the unit. I used the other to cut off a tentacle. It took more work than it should have, with me sawing the flailing limb while it hosed out thick, oily liquid mixed with blinding showers of sparks into my faceplate. All around me, glowing blades of energy slashed and burned. The enemy didn't fall like cut grass, however. Their limbs were thicker than a man's leg, and the metallic outer layer of scales seemed to resist our weapons, slowing us down. It took about 2 full seconds of sawing to remove a tentacle from an alien body while it thrashed about, smashing whatever got in its way. I was impressed, as I knew human flesh could never have withstood a force blade for that long. In the end, we won the fight. Graves urged us to take a prisoner, but it was impossible. They never gave any hint that they were interested in surrender or retreat. They attacked with every shred of vigor in their massive, strange bodies until we brought them down and diced them. I watched the last one go down with a soldier's foot in its beak-like mouth. The man was howling in fury and pain. He sawed at the central knot of flesh, but the beak wouldn't let go. It crunched down, sparking and rasping on his metal boot, chewing on it. Finally, we climbed on the shivering mass and stabbed our blades deep into it over and over until it stopped struggling. The trooper's boot was mangled, and he said his foot had been crushed. A bio administered a sedative, then looked at Graves, who managed to stand up. Graves examined the trooper's crushed foot, then nodded. "Shit," said the man. He closed his eyes. Carlos and I watched, gritting our teeth, as the bio used her tapper to activate the suit's survival systems. She pushed a button, confirmed it twice, and we all heard a snap and a crunch. The suit had amputated the man's foot. A sizzling sound followed, and the wound was cauterized.
"Ugly," Carlos said. "Better than getting perm, though."
I told him to shut up. And for once, he did. We counted our wounded and our dead. We'd lost 18 troops and killed 7 aliens. I didn't like the odds. We had no idea how many of them might be aboard. "We have to have reinforcements, Vet," I told Harris. He looked at me with wide eyes. His breath panted slightly in the transmitted reply.
"No shit. Is that what you really think? I was going to kill them all personally."
Graves walked up to me and picked up my cannon.
"Your weapon isn't in your hands, Specialist,"
he said sternly. He looked my cannon over carefully. I noticed that he paid no attention to the wounded around him. He was more interested in the status of my tube than he was in my health.
"This is one of only 2 working heavy weapons,"
he said, handing the tube over to me.
"I want to keep it operating. It's worth more than any of us."
"How do you figure that, sir?" I asked. Veteran Harris put his hands on his hips and glowered at me, but the Centurion took the question well enough.
"I know you didn't see much of that fight, as you were resting on your back throughout most of it. But at range, these 2 tubes are the only effective weapons we have. Sargon took 1 down. You incapacitated 2 more. The other 4 aliens got in close and did a lot of damage. I'd rather take them out at range, wouldn't you?"
I nodded, conceding his point. I checked my tube and ran a diagnostic set of tests on it with my tapper. "She's a little banged up, but she'll fire," I said. Graves nodded and waved for everyone's attention. He had all the non-coms gather around the mess on the floor. He focused on the first alien we'd killed, the one Sargon had put a big hole into. He turned to Natasha, who was the only tech in the group.
"Tell me what we're facing here. Is this thing's outer skin organic or not?"
Natasha limped to us and dug into the alien flesh, which shivered slightly at her touch. She didn't seem squeamish in the slightest. I recalled her interest in biological oddities. Once again, she seemed fascinated by what she saw.
"No," she said. "I'd say this is a polymer covering, something like a thick hose that forms a sheath over their natural limbs. See the layering here? The suit is tight, but I'm sure it's a suit."
I watched, impressed. She dug around inside the alien's smoking carcass like a pro.
That's what I thought, Graves said. What about these external scales?
A protective layer,
Natasha said.
Light armor, I'd say. Maybe these aliens are wearing their equivalent of spacesuits. The material doesn't look smart, however. I'm not seeing any attempt by the fabric to re-knit itself together. Nothing like an auto-healing system, either. It is a basic, protective spacesuit.
Graves stood up and put his hands on his hips.
No armament. No galactic tech to speak of. I take this as a good sign. They're not all that advanced.
Excuse me, sir, I said. They did manage to penetrate a warp bubble and attack a ship inside.
Graves shook his head at me. Negative. They jumped our ship as we left warp.
I must have looked confused because he chuckled.
They're tricky, but they're not techno-wizards. We came out of warp when the Skrull sensed an uncharted field of debris directly in our path. Remember that a warp ship is still vulnerable to mines and the like. We shifted out of warp to change course. That's when they struck.
No mines, sir?
No, just an ambush.
I nodded. A decoy. They faked us out like bandits on a highway.
Exactly, Graves said. Smart, strong, and tricky, but not overly advanced.
I was willing to accept his verdict, but Carlos wasn't.
Sir, Carlos said, how did they get out here? How'd they figure out exactly where and when this ship would show up?
We're not the first. We're on a known shipping lane. Galactic ships have come through the system before. The Galactics have been watching this system, but I think it was for different reasons than we'd previously assumed. In any case, these aliens must have known we'd arrive here and were lying in wait for us.
His thoughts asked as many questions as they answered, but I decided to keep quiet about that for now. Were the aliens waylaying any ship that came into their system? That seemed ballsy. They'd been given the Empire's ultimatum. Join and submit, or die. Perhaps they didn't take it seriously.
But sir, I asked, what about the colonists who are supposed to be out here? Where did these aliens come from? How do they fit in?
What I want to hear from you is fewer questions and more answers. Let's focus on retaking the ship. We'll figure out the big picture later, if there is a later.
Yes, sir.
What came next, I should have expected, but somehow I was surprised.
We're advancing up this passage to the bridge,
Veteran Harris said.
Sargon, McGill, you're leading the way.
A minute later, I found myself moving down the tube-like passageway toward the dark, far end. I had my cannon on my shoulder, and I was sweating inside my suit. Every step, I expected massive aliens to spring out of the walls at me. We reached the next bulkhead without further incident. I felt relieved, but this was far from over. As troops clanked forward on my flanks and worked the next hatch, I directed my tube at the door. The scene was too familiar. I had to wonder if we were walking into another ambush. If the aliens didn't have ranged weapons, they'd be smart to keep attacking us when we were all bunched up at a hatchway. Veteran Harris came closer to me as troops worked on the hatch. They were having trouble of some kind.
They'll have it open in a second, he said. You still have that weapon dialed for a broad spray.
Haven't changed it, Vet.
He nodded.
I think that was a good call. Not to say Sargon's choice was wrong, but if they're hiding on the far side of this hatch, you'll be able to spray them in the face again.
Sargon knelt beside me and stared at the closed hatch with fixed concentration.
Vet's right, he said.
I was worried, but you played that last encounter like a pro. I guess you're a heavy weaponeer now for real.
Just doing my job, I said.
Inside my helmet, I smiled, enjoying the praise. I knew I'd have to make the most of it. In Legion Varus, a kind word is a rare thing. We watched for about a minute, but the hatchway didn't open. Graves stomped forward, irritated.
What's the holdup?
Stuck, sir, Carlos said. The techs are working on it, but the hinges are jammed or something.
So,
Force it open.
Natasha joined the conversation. She stood near Sargon and I, who were still watching the hatch for any sign of the enemy ambush. Anyone caught between our heavy tubes and that hatchway would be in a bad spot if the situation turned hot.
Can't do that, Centurion, Natasha said. This is Skrull tech, and we don't have the codes to override it or blow the hinges. If the hatch doesn't work, we'll have to go around.
We could burn through the door, he said.
She shook her head.
Bad idea. These bulkheads protect the bridge. If they won't open, it's probably for a good reason.
Graves stared at her.
Are you suggesting there's active fire on the far side?
That, or hard vacuum.
Graves thought about it.
I don't care, he said. We're breaking in.
We should know what we're up against first, sir, Natasha protested.
Then figure it out. Sargon, burn me a hole in that door. Will you do all the damage to the bottom half?
Stay clear,
Sargon shouted. People scuttled out of the way, all except Natasha.
I have a better idea, she said.
Let's hear it, Graves said.
Let me send in a buzzer.
A buzzer was a tiny, snooping drone. Tex kept them in their bag of tricks on their backs. Graves waved for Sargon to stand down.
How will you get one past the hatch?
He asked Natasha. Natasha produced a buzzer about the size of her thumb, which resembled a cockroach. It was a yellow, metallic color, similar to tin. She moved to the hatch control panel she'd been messing with and opened it.
There are conduits that lead to the far side. I'll set this one on a scouting mission and let him go. With your permission, sir.
Do it.
The buzzer crawled from Natasha's hand and entered the panel. It soon vanished. She activated her tapper. I wanted to watch but stayed in position, aiming my weapon at the hatch.
I'll pipe the signal to everyone's tapper, she said.
A moment later, a flickering, fish-eyed vid began to play on my arm. I put it low on the interior screens in my helmet so I could watch and keep my eyes on the hatch while it played. The buzzer crept its way through a dark, crowded environment. Everything it saw was very small, but screws looked like pillars from its point of view. Finally, it found its way out on the far side. The passage looked dark and empty. I saw its four tiny wings extend. They flapped and buzzed, but it couldn't take off. Natasha looked back at us.
Vacuum, she said. There's no air. It can't fly.
That's it, then. You sealed the first hatch behind us, didn't you?
Natasha nodded.
Brace yourselves, everyone, he said.
Then he looked at me and Sargon.
Blow the hatch.
Chapter 8. We burned through the hatch in less than a minute. When it finally breached, a screeching roar began. The air around us was sucked out of the punch-through hole we'd burned into the center of the lower steel leaf. It took a while for the air to all be sucked away, and Sargon and I kept blasting. We'd set our weapons to lower yield with pulsing emissions. That wasn't optimal for combat, where you wanted to hit your target with a killing bolt of plasma, but for a stationary target like a hatchway, it worked well. The beams lasted for several seconds each, then we had to recycle the units and let them cool down before firing again. We kept working while the air around us leaked away. Everyone had their helmets on, and the hatch behind us had been sealed. But there was still quite a bit of air that needed to escape from the long passageway. As I worked to burn the hole larger, I wondered what we'd find on the far side. I could tell that there wasn't going to be any air pressure. This leak wasn't the mild hiss you got when two chambers were equalizing pressure. This was the all-out rush of gas that occurs when there's nothing but space, hard vacuum, on the far side of a breach. Whatever we found, I was now certain we weren't going to encounter any living Skrull crewmen. They couldn't have survived this attack on the bridge. When we had a glowing orange-black opening the size of a manhole, we stopped firing. Two troops were ordered to wriggle into the dark chamber first. We waited a minute or so, watching them as they struggled and grunted to get through. Then they walked around on magnetic boots in the cold chamber beyond. They transmitted back what they saw on their suit vid, just as the buzzer had done. One of the two was Kiwi, and she did the talking, as they reported on what they saw.
No gravity, she said. No atmosphere. It's deserted in here, sir.
Do a quick sweep, Graves said. Then open up the hatch from the inside.
I glanced at him, wondering why he didn't just have them open the hatch right away and get it over with. The pressure had equalized, so there wouldn't be any explosive equalization. With the hatch open, we could support our two scouts if something went drastically wrong. After another moment's thought, I finally got it. Right, I muttered to myself inside the helmet. Centurion Graves didn't want the hatch yawning open if there was going to be trouble. The heavies on the wrong side of the door would just have to deal with it alone. And we would be left with more options as to how to respond. Possibly for the first time, I was glad I was now a specialist with a valuable tube and the skill to use it. The more expendable types were inside that dark chamber now, exploring. We watched, tensely. Kiwi sounded nervous, but she was game. She'd toughened up since our first mission into alien space.
Checking the corridors? Main power seems to be cut, Centurion. This module seems to be running on auxiliary batteries as far as I can tell.
Graves didn't speak. He watched the vids intently. Most of the rest of us did the same. I noticed that Sargon wasn't watching the streaming transmissions. Instead, he'd repositioned himself to one side of the hole we'd burned through the hatch. His weapon was shouldered and ready. I realized he was watching that hole like a cat hunting for a mouse. I joined him, thinking he was doing the right thing. Graves flicked his eyes over the two of us. He didn't say anything, but he nodded in approval. That was nice for a change. Kiwi made a sweep of the immediate area beyond the hatch, then opened the big doors. We tensed. After having been rushed by about 10 tons of armored squids, we were nervous. I took a look around as we advanced. We were in the Skrull living quarters. At least that's what I figured they were. Dead Skrull littered the place. Unfortunately, as we were in null gravity, they were floating, not resting peacefully on the deck. Skrull are a weird-looking species. They aren't very big, maybe a meter long from stem to stern, with wrinkled-up faces that are vaguely humanoid, and hard shells over their central bodies. Several thin limbs come out of this shell. The limbs looked disturbingly like the arms of dead children, as they drifted in frozen rifts of their own blood. They'd been killed, then frozen by the hard vacuum.
What do they call those freaky monkeys from Madagascar?
Carlos asked me. I thought about it.
Lemurs? Yeah, that's what these guys look like. Big yellow eyes.
I was thinking of turtles with long skinny arms and humanoid faces.
Sure, that fits too.
We hadn't seen the Skrull all that often, even though we'd technically spent over a year in space with them. It struck me how you could live with another species and not really know them, because each group stayed with their own kind. Now, they look more like kin to me. Basically a peaceful, effective people. They'd been slaughtered wholesale like animals.
This kind of pisses me off, I said as we waded forward,
heading down narrow passageways toward the central shaft that led to the control rooms. As I spoke, I had to reach out and push away gauzy, frozen mists of blood. The mists looked like crackling spider webs, breaking at the slightest touch.
Why?
Carlos asked.
I don't know. They weren't hurting anyone. They have red blood the same as us, too. I didn't know that.
Carlos laughed.
You're such a hater, McGill. Why not love those snake-armed killing machines? True, they aren't nice, but then neither are we. Remember, the Galactics invaded their system and started giving them orders. You have to admit these giant armored squid dudes have balls. They're fighting harder than we did.
I nodded thoughtfully. I didn't usually expect Carlos to have anything deep to add to a conversation, but this time he had pulled it off.
You got a point, I admitted. That's enough chatter up there, Veteran Harris said, pushing his way past a few troops to get close to us.
Ortiz, stop distracting the specialist. We need his gun and his eye alert, if you want to keep breathing.
Would it help if I just offed myself right here, vet?
Carlos asked. That would really, really make me happy, Harris told him, and I believed him. But no, we need your sorry ass too. Just shut the hell up.
Since the Skrull were smaller than humans and we were in heavy armor, the going was tough. I had to wonder about the enemy. They were comparatively huge. How had they managed to maneuver through these tunnels?
Contact!
Shouted a voice from the front line. I was pretty sure it was Kivi. I pushed forward, but Sargon contacted me privately.
Let the regulars engage first, he said. You don't rush in when you have the only weapon that works.
I held back, but it wasn't easy. It went against my basic nature. I wanted to help Kivi, but at the same time I knew Sargon was right. He didn't always hold himself back, but this mission was too critical. We just didn't know what we were up against. Hell, if I died right now, I didn't know if I'd ever be revived. The rest of the Legion, where the revival machines were, was still out of contact. Sliding to the side and parking myself in an alcove, I felt a few heavies drag themselves past me. They looked like they were climbing a ladder underwater. In Null G, pretty much everyone moves like they're swimming, dragging themselves from one handhold to the next and kicking off from any handy surface. You couldn't just walk or crawl as there was no gravity to hold you down to the deck and give you the grip you needed for such forms of locomotion. Carlos was one of the troopers who rushed ahead of me, obeying Graves and Harris. He thumbed his nose at me, or at least it was a close approximation. His faceplate got in the way of the full gesture. My breathing accelerated as I rejoined the flow and moved forward. I was the fourth man as we emerged into a larger, more open area. Kivi called out, "Contact!" meaning she'd found the enemy. But when I came out of the gopher hole that terminated the passageway, I didn't see any armored squids. "Where are they?" I asked.
2 o'clock, she said. "Look."
Kivi was hugging the aft wall. I saw she was staring and pointing a weapon toward an opening. It took me a moment to realize what I was looking at. There was a large rip in the hull of the ship. It was right there on the top dome of the observational deck of the bridge. The rip was about 5 meters long and maybe 2 wide, and it impressed me in more ways than one. "I don't see any squids," I radioed, aiming my weapon at the rip. Flanges of dark metal drifted, and I could see starlight beyond the rip, illuminating the outer hull.
"I did,"
she said, breathing hard over the microphone in her helmet.
"It was just a shadow, a fast movement. Something jumped over that breach up there."
Sargon and I put our backs against the deck and aimed up at the breach. If something did rush us, we'd have time for one good shot. That was it.
"Report, Sargon," Veteran Harris said. "Are we moving into the chamber or not?"
"Your call, vet," he said. "There's been a sighting. There could be a million of them crawling on the hull or only one."
Harris cursed and kicked the decision back up the chain to the officers who were in the rear. They moved the rest of the troops up, apparently not liking their position any better than I had when I was in that hole. A few more of our troops came up onto the bridge. Maybe that's what the enemy had been waiting for. I'll never know for sure. As our troops began surging up one at a time into the chamber, the squids made their move. In space, humans are rather clumsy. We're used to gravity, and we don't operate well without it. Worse, we need air to breathe and a lot of temperature controls in order to be comfortable. As bad as I'd thought fighting on Steel World had been, it was a picnic compared to fighting in space. Our opponents were not as disadvantaged as we were. They had many limbs, not just 4. They could use any of them in any configuration to grip a wall or some other hold, anchor themselves, and get leverage. In addition, they seemed to feel more at home in space. They swam in it as if it was water. I was immediately struck by this as they began appearing at the breach overhead and darting down through it like fish. I knew in that instant that they were at least a partially aquatic species. I thought they looked pretty agile, loping on those tentacles to overrun us the first time, but they looked even more graceful in Null G. Chapter 9. I didn't fire right off. Instead, I waited about half a second. Sargon, to my surprise, did the same. Then we both let go at almost the same moment. Gouts of plasma leapt up in unison toward the dozen or so enemy. They withered instantly in response because both Sargon and I had dialed our weapons for broad cones of fire. Only two of the monsters made it to us, but that was enough to do a lot of damage. My tube was plucked from my grasping gauntlets by the tentacle of one of them. The creature methodically raised and lowered the tube. I barely had time to shy away as the weapon crashed down upon my shoulder plate. If I hadn't been wearing heavy armor, I'd have suffered a broken collarbone at the least. Perhaps I'd have been struck dead. Fortunately, my armor held, but the tube itself was damaged. Despite my peril, I was more worried about my weapon than I was my own life. My body could be repaired more easily than the alien weapon, and others could wield it if I fell. The cannon seemed to be our best defense against these creatures, and I had no idea how many more we might have to defeat. I reached for the tube and struggled to take it back before the thrashing alien clubbed more of us with it. I grabbed it and hung on. Back home, I'd ridden mechanical bulls upon occasion, usually while seriously intoxicated. I wished I'd had a few drinks in me now. The squid didn't want to give back my tube, and that thing was strong. It lashed its limbs like whips, and I went flying with them. Only the power of my exoskeletal suit and the fact I'd managed to wrap my fist into the shoulder strap allowed me to hang on at all. To tell the truth, the next 15 seconds were a blur. I was whipping around like a rag doll, vaguely aware of the rest of my unit engaging this creature and the other one that had made it in too close. They stabbed the squids and slashed away their tentacles. They had a plan now, and the process went more cleanly this time. By the time my squid stopped thrashing, my helmet was starred and my brains were a little rattled. Kibi made it to me first. She stared worriedly into my faceplate.
"Hi,"
I said.
"You're alive?"
"I think so." She slapped my helmet, which made me wince. My neck hurt, but I managed to force a smile. "Help me up," I said. She did, and I managed to get my magnetic boots to clamp onto the deck. I stood unsteadily, glad my suit could almost balance itself. The world was spinning.
"Did you puke in that suit?"
Harris asked, coming close and glaring into the faceplate at me.
"No, sir," I said. "But I think I have a leak. Something's flashing on my oxygen supply meter."
"What's the reading?"
"Can't tell, sir. That part of the glass is cracked too badly."
"Crazy mother,"
he said, giving me a shake. He shouted over his shoulder,
"Tech!"
Natasha came over and began working on my suit. She clucked and cursed at me in even proportions. Soon she had a glaze of fresh plastic crawling across the inside of my visor. I assumed it was a nanite repair kit she was applying. They'd heat up, then remelt the plastic, forming a fresh glaze. It would be a little blurry, but much better than a network of cracks. Best of all, my suit would be airtight again. Graves came over to me next. He looked me over with a critical eye.
"Are you functional, specialist?"
"Yes, sir,"
I said in the strongest voice I could muster.
"I'm doing fine."
Weakness was a bad thing to let on about in Legion Varus. If I couldn't keep up, it might be for the best for the unit to put me down. Normally, that wouldn't be such a bad thing because you'd get a fresh body an hour or so later. But today I didn't want to risk it. As far as I knew, we might never re-establish contact with the rest of the Legion.
"You went for quite a ride,"
Graves said.
"Was that an accident? I noticed your gauntlet was caught in your straps."
"No, sir," I said. "I didn't want the creature to have my weapon."
Graves chewed that over for a moment, then nodded.
"Excellent,"
he said, and left. I watched him through my visor, which was now slightly warped rather than nearly opaque. The nanites were dying off, having run out of power. Nanites didn't live long. They usually didn't have batteries that lasted more than a few minutes. A fine dust of metal tickled my nose and fell away like steel filings. They bugged my skin slightly, and the sensation was like the one I always had after a haircut. I knew I needed a shower to wash them away completely, but that wasn't happening any time soon. Natasha watched me.
"Use your tapper to evacuate the dust from your helmet," she told me. "You don't want that dust to get into your lungs. Dead nanites can be carcinogens."
I did as she suggested. The prickly sensation on my skin was still there, but less intense. Within a few minutes, I no longer needed to sneeze. While I was recovering, the rest of the team searched the bridge. I joined them when I could. All around the walls, there were control systems and odd-looking perches with straps too short to support anyone larger than a child. The screens were dead, however, and the safety straps were floating in the void. The scouts Graves had sent up through the rip in the ceiling came down as we looked around. They'd been crawling out there, checking on the external hull. They gave us the thumbs up, having met with nothing but vacuum and debris.
"I think we have a good idea of how the attack went down," Graves said, addressing the survivors a few minutes later.
There were only about half of us left alive, I noted, with some alarm.
"The aliens ripped open the hull and came onto the bridge directly into the control center. I would guess the Skrull were caught by surprise. They probably didn't expect an assault the moment they came out of warp. The vacuum probably killed them as fast as anything else. Not many bodies in the seats. They were probably sucked out into space."
I thought about it. I could see the attack in my mind. A sudden explosion, a gush of hot air out into the absolute cold that was space. The Skrull must have died in horror and anguish, wondering what was happening to them and their ship.
"But sir," I said, "what was the enemy's ultimate goal? Did they hope to destroy the ship or capture it?"
"Doesn't matter much now," Graves said. "I doubt they expected stiff resistance. We amounted to an effective security force."
I nodded, but wasn't satisfied with the answers he'd come up with so far. How had they pulled this off? I'd never heard of anyone attacking a starship before. I guessed that was because the Empire was too terrifying. No one dared.
"Do you think we got them all, sir?"
Carlos asked. Graves grunted noncommittally.
"We'll find out soon enough. I want everyone to help Natasha get the power back up. Harris, get a detail on that rip in the ceiling. Use some emergency decking and patch it up."
"Are we going to repressurize, sir?"
Harris asked.
"If we're lucky."
We got to work then. The enemy didn't attack right away, and for that I was very glad. I could still feel the bruises and scrapes my armor had created when that last squid had given me the ragdoll treatment. We pushed the alien bodies out of the rip one by one, but saved the corpse that was the least damaged. Graves explained we had to keep one for the bio people to dissect later on. The whole process took several hours, but we managed to get the power up again. Very quickly, we had a comm link up to the rest of the Legion in the main sector of the ship. I was happy to learn they hadn't all been killed in the attack. Primus Turov spoke to us personally when we'd managed to get her on the line.
"I want to congratulate you all on a job well done," she began. "Graves, you just formed up that heavy unit, and I'm frankly shocked you pulled this off without help."
That statement could be taken as an insult or a compliment, and coming from Turov, I suspected it was intended to be a little of both. Graves took it all in stride, however.
"Thank you, Primus. Legion Varus always gets the job done."
"Exactly. Now I want to discuss with your team what we're going to do next. I'm going to report to the Tribune for the final decision, of course."
"Naturally,"
Graves said. Inside my own quiet helmet, I translated the true meaning of her words. I was beginning to know my commanders and how the Legion operated as a whole. What the Primus meant was she would gather all the intel from us, then turn around and deliver it to the Legion's overall commander, Tribune Drusus. That way, she could hog all the glory for a mission in which she'd avoided all personal involvement.
"Here's how I see it," Turov began. "There's only one explanation for the situation. We've encountered a new, unknown, definitely feral species. It's a worst-case scenario, really. The Galactics probably knew we were here all along, but hadn't gotten around to dropping the hammer on them. Sometimes a race of beings is so vicious they can't be reasoned with. I've read about cases like this. Usually a truly savage race would rather fight to the finish than give in to the Empire. That's their choice, and they invariably suffer the consequences. Humanity was considered borderline in comparison. We were almost too savage to become a civilized world. Even after our application was accepted and our viability as a trader of mercenary troops was proven, some factions within the Empire wanted us excised, predicting we would be trouble down the road. We were closer to being snuffed out right there from the start than most people realize.
Her little speech impressed me. She had a better grasp of the situation than I'd thought, and I'd learned a few things along the way. In Legion Varus, we generally operated on a need-to-know basis. Things were safer that way. But with the internal Legion politics involved, lower-level people rarely got the whole story about anything.
"Does anyone have anything to add?"
Turov asked. Her holographic image was in the center of the dark, circular chamber. Most of us had gathered around listening to her, but Natasha and several others were working on the ship's systems. The ship was designed to be operated by the Skrull, but most subsystems had been produced somewhere within the Empire and were built for a default humanoid manipulation. Standard symbols and fittings were everywhere, and every member of the Empire learned how to handle Imperial computer interfaces almost before they learned to speak. The controls were very intuitive and largely based upon touch. When I saw no one was going to speak up, I stood and addressed her. She looked at me expectantly. As we were still in a hard vacuum, I couldn't open my helmet. I realized she probably didn't know who I was. That was just as well, but I knew I had to identify myself. "Specialist McGill speaking, sir," I said. "I'm wondering about the human colonists that were supposed to be out here. What happened to them?" Primus Turov's expression darkened the moment she heard my name. I could tell right away she hadn't forgotten about me.
"That's a question, and it's not going to help with my report," she snapped. "But the truth is that the colonists are probably all dead. With a local nest of vicious aliens like these in the system, how could they have survived?"
"Are you sure that the squid aliens came from this system?"
"It's possible," she said. "We really don't know. What we do know is that our mission here is complete and successful. We are charged with eliminating a threat to Earth's livelihood, and we have done just that. Well, actually, the aliens did the job for us. By attacking a galactic ship, they sealed their own fate. As soon as we can get Corvos operational again, we'll report what happened to the Galactics, and the system will be slated for cleansing. Problem solved."
I frowned but nodded and sat back down. I didn't buy her theory concerning the colonists. They were our kin, after all, and some of them might still be around. I didn't like the idea of telling the Galactics they should erase all life from this system.
"Anything else?"
Turov asked in a tone that indicated she didn't want to hear any more from anyone. Natasha stepped up. She had a worried look on her face.
"Primus, Centurion?" she said seriously. "Navigation isn't responding. I think it's damaged."
"Well then, repair it,"
Primus Turov said tightly.
"We should leave this system before any more rapid aliens get ideas."
"That's just it, sir. I don't think we have enough time left to effect repairs."
"Explain yourself."
"The ship has changed course. I can only think that the invaders did it. Or maybe it was the Skrull in a last-ditch attempt to screw their killers. I don't know, really."
"What the hell are you talking about, Specialist?"
Turov said.
"Sorry, sir,"
Natasha said, straightening her spine visibly.
"I will attempt to be clear. This ship is flying directly toward Zeta Herculis, the star itself, and I can't change course because the helm controls have been damaged."
"How long do we have?"
Graves asked, joining the conversation.
17 hours, according to the nav computer. Maybe twice that if we can get some braking jets to fire.
Do what you can,
Graves said. He turned and regarded the projected image of Turov, who looked stunned.
This changes everything, Primus. I've just sent a priority code text to Tribune Drusus. He wants to talk to us in person.
Turov.